Welcome to this week's Big Mouth Podcast, the cultural detournement for the modern flaneur who likes to drift around the sprawling cul-de-sac we call popular entertainment in a big hat. I'm Andrew Harrison, and I'm joined by co-presenter and self-styled dawdler, Sean Pattenden, to navigate this particular art arrondissement. Today, we'll be discussing hotly tipped and heavily rouged skate pick I, Tonya, starring Margot Robbie as embattled ice queen Tonya Harding.
We'll also be wondering if Canadian multi-instrumentalist Megan Remy has been at the Helium as we investigate her band US Girls pop dance long player In A Poem Unlimited.
And we'll take a Wakanda wild side, did you see what we did there, with a visit to the secretive African Technopolis where Marvel's latest superhero movie Black Panther takes place. It's not actually about the Black Panthers, but it might as well have Angela Davis in it. Also, we'll be revisiting the album that nobody likes but me. Our guests will choose the record which clears the proverbial room when you need all those people to just go home, but that they themselves adore.
In which case, we better meet those guests. Journalist and broadcaster Sally Hughes is the queen of maquillage and makeup, which is actually the same thing, I think. She writes for The Guardian, The Paul and Empire, and her new book, Pretty Iconic, is out now. And she's a regular DJ on Soho Radio. Hello, Sally. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
Can you advise what's the best lipstick to wear at a sweaty gig?
I believe in a red lipstick because you don't have to do anything else. Just whack on a red and you're immediately dressed up.
But would you be matte or would you be gloss?
I'd be matte, especially in a sweaty gig because it's going to go all over your face if it's glossy. Also matte, go hard or go home, I think.
Oh, okay.
For a big bold
right.
colour.
Hard line already.
It's got to be red in the dark environment of the flashing disco lights and so forth to stand out.
You just feel immediately dressed up. You can turn up in your jeans and t-shirt, make no other effort whatsoever and just pop on a red lipstick and you feel ready to go out.
Excellent. This is good stuff. And can you advise what sort of moisturiser would you recommend to Liam Gallagher? Because he looks like he's starting to need a little bit of help.
Oh, God. Anything that restricts the movement of his mouth, maybe?
Great.
So plaster of Paris or something like that.
Yeah.
Also with us is Michael Hann, music journalist for The Guardian, The Financial Times, The Spectator and whomever else will have him. Hello, Michael. What's your go-to moisturiser?
Well, I've never used any sort of moisturiser, and I wash my face using soap to the immense distress of both my wife and daughter. But as I point out, I'm 48 and my skin actually still looks quite good for 48.
It does actually.
Well, yeah. like you are you're a man of a beard like me. And well, it covers a multitude of sins, doesn't it?
I'll shave off the beard so you can see the skin, not live on air. That would be wrong. I did once when I was on staff at The Guardian have to do a feature where I did moisturise for a month to see if it made any discernible difference. Mm. But it did make no difference, and the experiment had to end when I was shoveling ice and snow off my in-law's drive and put my back out. And I was just too much pain to actually spend any time in front of the mirror rubbing everything in. I just wanted to lie down the whole time
so
after that.
More about lower back imprecations rather than...
Yeah.
Very nice. Sean, as Scully to my Mulder, can you recommend me something that has an 8-hour flawless coverage and won't break the bank?
I'm going to give you some tips later.
Okay, lovely. Yeah. Before we get started, let's have a few words about Big Mouth.
We are over the moon. So many people like Big Mouth and listen to it at home and on the move because it's portable and fuss-free. But unfortunately, we have studio and production bills to pay. So if you like Big Mouth, and we think that you may, we have a simple and very, 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 very polite request. Will you buy us a pint or a soft drink alternative once a month via the crowdfunding platform Patreon? Not a real pint, of course, although that could be arranged, but a virtual pint to help us cover our studio and production bills. We're aiming to raise £600 a month, which is equal to 120 listeners buying us a pint at crazy London prices, or, if my maths is correct, 180 listeners opting for a Wetherspoons brunchette. When we get to that £600 a month mark, we'll do an extra fun segment each week, especially for our Patreon backers. And we're already a quarter of the way there. Yay! You laugh. But you can go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. There's also a link at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page. All we are saying is buy us a pint or a toast and tea. Now, few films, probably none, fully express the wiles and intrigue behind competitive figure skating. That Torval and Dean biopic is certainly still in formative planning stages. But with Margot Robbie up for Best Actress Oscar and co-star Alison Janney for Best Supporting Actress, I, Tonya, could be the one. Do American tan tights, spandex, and the worst mum in the world, who looks a lot like Deirdre Barlow from Coronation Street, make for a satisfying cinematic experience? And should they have called it Blade Runner 1994? Let's have an excerpt.
There's no such thing as truth. Everyone has their own truth. I was the best figure skater in the world at one point in time.
You call that a clean skate? Stop talking to her. That girl is your enemy.
Waiting for the
breakup day. Jeff was my first date ever. And my mom came.
Ice Crazy, a bit of the Tonya Harding drama doc biopic, I, Tonya, there. Sally Hughes. Now, we know Tonya Harding for the violent nobbling of rink rival Nancy Kerrigan, but the movie's actually, it's much more of a slice of Americana, isn't it? And the underbelly that nobody cares about.
It is. It's a film about class, essentially. It's about class and not fitting in, and it's about domestic violence and poverty. And not quite having the right face to fit an entire industry and sport. It's absolutely brilliant. I loved it so much. And there have been a few sort of problematic columns written about it, saying that actually we shouldn't make a hero out of Tonya Harding when she accepted a plea bargain of guilt and so on in the assault of Nancy Kerrigan, which she didn't physically do herself, but nonetheless she took the plea. And so officially she has accepted that she knew about it, although she says that she didn't. But I think it's perfectly fine to make a victim out of Tonya Harding, because it is beyond question that she was an abused child and woman. She had known violence her entire life. Making somebody a victim doesn't take away the victimhood of the person who was perpetrated against.
I really enjoyed it. I thought she was more than a victim. I thought this is we've all experienced this story as like a kitschy, tatty,
yes,
American losers, look at these idiots thing. We experience it third and fourth hand through our own media. Close up, you really do see that this is somebody who had her life stacked against her so horribly,
yeah,
and still came through it and then failed. She got what she always wanted and had it taken away from a series of very small, simple bad decisions.
Yeah, it doesn't have the rocky ending, does it? You know, it has quite a bleak ending. And really, as well as being about class and domestic violence, it's also about the culture of celebrity and how somebody can very quickly become a punchline if they're seen as a bit below stairs. I think it's quite frightening in that regard, where you see her journey where she's kind of flavour of the month because she lands a triple axel, then she's not flavour of the month because she's a bit common, then she's really not flavour of the month because of this assault.
Yeah.
And it's a story of how we consume celebrities and sort of chew them up and spit them out. And I thought it was really interesting the way it really makes you think afterwards, the number of people who are famous for 5 minutes and then just become a bit of a joke on Twitter.
Well, it made me think, because I felt, you know, obviously this is the pre-Twitter era, but we've all sort of shared gags about, know, look at Tonya Harding. And it makes you think, how many times in the social media era have you been complicit in that monstering and tearing down of somebody who, you know, everybody's private story is a struggle, and we tend to look at them as cartoons. Michael, what did you think of the movie?
I thought it was absolutely brilliant. It had me from very early on, when the infant Tonya takes to the ice for the first time and the soundtrack plays Devil Woman by Cliff Richard.
There's a lot of Michael Hand music on this, actually.
Soundtrack's a banger.
We were agreeing on this coming out the screening. Yeah. What a great soundtrack.
There's a lot of driving rock.
Laura Branigan.
Yeah.
Lots of good stuff.
Yeah. By which I mean not rock that's driving, but rock for driving too. Yeah.
But I agree with Tyler, it's about class, but I think it's about something more than that. It's about power, because every single character, every single one of the principals in I, Tonya is compensating for their lack of power in some way. They are all powerless, and they are all reacting to that. So from the buffoonish bodyguard, Eckhard, whose reaction to his own lack of power is to make up this story about how he works for the secret services around the world, when in fact he lives with his parents and still perpetuates this lie. From, you know, Tonya's mother, who's brilliantly played by Alison Janney as this brutal harridan, but she has no control over her life. Tonya has no control over her life. Her husband, played by Sebastian Stan, has no control over his life. And what it reminded me actually of was Hillbilly Elegy, which is about exactly the same kind of people. It's a different kind of story. But Hillbilly Elegy is the non-fiction sensation of the Trump years, about, you know, people reacting to their own powerlessness. And there's a section towards the end of Hillbilly Elegy where the author, whose name now escapes me, obviously, talks about trying to get to college and finally discovering it's, in fact, easier for him to go to Yale than it is to go to a state university because there's so many more subsidies. But the point is that people who are cut off from society are not aware of the opportunities that are open to them. And yet, the people in I, Tonya are people who are completely cut off from society, and they don't understand the rules that apply in figure skating or to anyone else.
Now, the classic response, when somebody mentions hillbilly elegy, somebody pops up and says, hang on, class tourism, that was just a little bit of let's go and wallow in the miseries of others, and America's not really like that. That tends to be the response.
Yeah, well, the fellow who wrote it was not a class tourist.
Yeah. No, but the response is that the readers are class tourists.
Yeah.
And is there any criticism of that to be levelled on Itonya? Personally, I loved it and thought it felt very real. But is there an element that perhaps it may be a case of, well, you can dip your toes in the wrong side of the tracks here and then wander off elsewhere?
Is it, again, a very good-looking woman playing a woman who's poor, not so good-looking? That star thing, if we know underneath, the perm, that there is Margot Robbie, who is not ugly at all, is playing down. Is it still holification?
Like Charlize Theron in...
Yeah. Yes, exactly, like Aileen Moronos, Monster, the film. Is there that Hollywoodification of, look, these poor people, and poor people get hit? And there was something about it when I was thinking, do poor people in America get... Is this the only representation we have of them? That their domestic abuse, they can't afford sweets. You know, she can't afford some of the groceries. And, you know, she's skating, she can do the triple axel. Only 6 people in the world have ever been able to do the triple axel. And there she is, and she can't afford, you know, to fill the freezer. Things like that.
Yeah.
Yes, at one point she's a waitress and training for the Olympics when everybody else is in their sexy rinks with their sponsored sportswear and she's just serving eggs or whatever. I mean, I think that's an interesting point about Margot Robbie. I didn't think I would like this film, or I didn't think I would approve of Margot Robbie, because I was cross about The Wolf of Wall Street, in that the real woman Margot Robbie was playing in The Wolf of Wall Street just looked like an ordinary woman, and suddenly she was a supermodel, which I felt changed the story slightly. Mm. And so I thought I might disapprove of her, but actually she's brilliant and it is her project, and I can see why she put herself in it. Why wouldn't you? If you've sweated blood, guts and tears to get this film off the ground, I can understand why she wanted that role. And the problem really is Hollywood. It's, you know, it's a real story. She really was abused. She really was hit. That's a real story. The fault is the fact that women who look ordinary don't get big leading roles in Hollywood.
I just want to mention a bit about the filmmaking. You said, you know, the it was her project, and it's clearly a real passion for her. I thought the actual filmmaking at a technical level was as stunning as a Star Wars movie. How did they manage to get in the thick of that skating action?
Yeah, that was
where
incredible.
Margot is. Clearly, Margot Robbie is not doing this because nobody can do this.
Well, the CGI wasn't irritating, was it? CGI can often be so distracting,
like,
but I thought
magic.
It was done with a light touch.
But it says in the production notes that no one at the moment can do the triple axel. There isn't a skater. There wasn't a body double. So they had to CGI an extra twist for that. The ice skating is filmed beautifully.
I thought
it was
placed
fantastic.
You in the middle of the ice skating and made you feel what it's like to do that. Which,
you can
as
almost
you say,
smell. You know that smell of an ice rink.
Yeah, but... You know, as you say,
Sean,
six people know how that feels. Yeah. And this movie makes you feel what it's like to be rotating at an unimaginable speed on ice rink.
Well, merging that point and Sean's point, I didn't feel like it was class tourism because we're not invited to laugh at the characters. We do laugh, you know.
Well,
because
there are
funny
quite
bits.
A lot of gags.
Yes, but we're not invited to point and laugh in that way, you know. When humour emerges, it is because something is funny. You could say that Eckhart is a ridiculous character, but he's the only ridiculous character in there. And when you see the clips at the end of the film from real-life interviews, he was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then it comes back to when Tonya Harding does the triple axel. And again, this is something you see recreated in the real-life clips at the end of the film, and you see her punch the air whilst in the middle of her routine and the joy. And I think that really connects you to the character, the sense of, oh, that is why she does it. This is why this whole film is here, because of the euphoria and skill of that person.
We have to talk about Tonya's mum.
She's amazing.
One of the great screen monsters. This is Mommy Dearest level.
She's a horror.
She's incredible. Yeah. She looks like Iggy Pop, but somehow less maternal and warm and caring than even Iggy in his words.
The incredible
She's
speech.
Never redeemed either. No, she's just woefully awful. Yeah.
Well, the incredible speech where Tonya has gone to the diner where her mum works, and her mum comes and sits with her, and Tonya is, you know, how could you do this to me? And Alison Janney, as her mother, says, I loved you so much that I made you hate me, because that was the only way to make you great. That's the sacrifice I made.
Yeah, yeah. But there is you mentioned control earlier on. That's the only control she has over Tonya, to turn Tonya into a champion. And it is, as well as being about poverty and class, because America tells itself it doesn't have a class system, it absolutely does. It's all about poverty and class. It is about how close your dreams can be. And for me, the fact that it's full of 80s pop and 90s dance pop and the figure skating all reflects so beautifully on the environment these characters are in. It's like your dreams are only a pop song away. They're only a slightly nicer leotard away. You could do this.
Well, you say,
and it's always out of reach.
But again, you say their dreams are only a pop song away, but in fact, that's one of the divisions. So when Tonya is dancing to ZZ Top, and, which obviously I think is great, and told you can't dance to ZZ Top because pop is de classe. Yeah. We don't do that here. And the class wall, and it's literally a wall. You can almost feel it between the well-spoken judges and her coach. They are two completely different sides which cannot be breached. I think it's brilliantly done.
I think we're agreed. This is a fantastic movie, aren't
brilliant.
We? I'm going to go and see it again. I'm going to make my mum go and see this because she's going to really dig it. She's going to really dig it.
Now, everyone can name an album they're convinced only they love. A record that makes their hearts sing with joy when everyone else is shouting, for the love of God, turn that off. Now and again, we like to ask our guests to stand up and defend theirs. Sally Hughes, I believe you are about to defend The Indefensible. What's your album that no one else likes, Sally?
Oh, I find this so hard to do because I'm friends with so many music journalists who are grumpy about so many things I love. I almost chose the Stone Roses first album because music journalists are just so grumpy and annoying about
it. Reverse ferret, I suppose, yes.
And then there's also, you know, everything has an ironic tinge where people, you know, like things that used to be terribly unpopular. So I chose Tin Machine, which, as you say, is completely indefensible. There is a method to my madness.
It's a difficult one. Yeah.
It's a difficult one. It has to be the most hated album by an artist people love.
Fair bet that a few Big Mouth listeners won't have heard this for a while, so we're going to get an excerpt of it.
Let's have a taste. So this is Tin Machine with Baby Can Dance. I'm the jumping man. Tin Machine with Baby Can Dance, Sally Hughes' album that only she likes. I've got to say, this isn't as bad as I remember it. I remember it genuinely being shocking, and it doesn't sound quite so bad now. It's got some good songs in it, a bit of Decaf Pixies. Sally, come on, defend
Pixies,
this thing.
It's right. Okay, I'm defending it because the third gig I ever went to was the Glass Spider Tour in Cardiff Arms Park, and it was the era of the Never Let Me Down album by David Bowie. And I was delighted to be there. I was 11. I was over the moon. It was one of my best days ever because I went to see David Bowie and the show looked incredible, even though the album was quite shit. After that period of Tonight, Never Let Me Down, and to a degree, Let's Dance, Bowie needed an antidote. He needed to do something. You could argue he needed to do something quite unpopular. So what he did is he founded Tin Machine, which was a band in the true sense of the word, in that it was completely democratic. They wrote the songs together. He needed to get out of that zone. And from my perspective, at that age, it allowed me to go and see David Bowie loads of times. So during Tin Machine, I saw David Bowie perform lots of times.
In a pub.
Well, I went to see Tin Machine in Wolverhampton. I saw them. I got a coach to Wolverhampton. I saw him. I saw them perform on various TV shows that I managed to blag tickets for. Can you remember that show? Was it The Roxy or something?
It's fair to say.
Capital City or something?
He was considered to be down the dumper, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And we thought he was never going to come out of the dumper again.
Yeah, and they were signed to London Records and I knew someone at London Records. So I kept going to see David Bowie for free when I wouldn't have been able to normally because Tin Machine were always playing and nobody wanted to go and see them. I like the album. I don't love it. As you say, it's much better than people remember because it's sort of taken on a life of its own. Yeah. It's one of those cliches that people trot out, sort of the Tin Machine album.
Well, it's a bit like Tonya Harding, isn't it? It's a punchline.
Yeah.
Bowie and Tin Machine is a punchline.
I think, though, Tin Machine is going to feature in the next David Bowie box set, which will be out in the autumn, presumably, as they have been for the last few years. So,
did you know it sold 2 million copies, that album?
Michael Hammond.
The second one's out of print.
I suspect the Bowie organisation will not be expecting as big sales for this box set featuring the mid-80s albums and Tin Machine as they have done for the previous two.
Possibly
which would be the imperial years.
But listening to this, I mean, for a kickoff, it is loads better than Never Let Me Down.
Loads.
That track we played then, Baby Can Dance, listening to it again, I realised that he actually revisits that melody in Where Are We Now. It's the chorus of Where Are We Now. Da, 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 It's the same thing. Yeah. So clearly he had a bit more love for Tin Machine than we remember.
Also, it's kind of an Iggy Pop album. Mm-hmm. So two of the members of Tin Machine were the Sales Brothers. And I think actually looking back, Hunt Sales, everybody hated, all journalists hated. And I think he really had quite a negative effect on their PR campaign. He was pretty dreadful.
The guitarist, wasn't he?
What did he do that was so dreadful?
I think he was surly and arrogant and egotistical. Yeah. I think that's the impression
I get.
Help,
is it?
It's not going to help.
Do you think it's a really masculine album? Because I wondered they were going to call it the Four Divorcees or something like that, because they were divorced at the time. And you can imagine them round, you know, in the bar in New York and all getting a bit
leery
with the ladies. We're going to do rock. And that's the thing that really put me off, is that it's a faux masculinity. Well, I like David Bowie because he looked a bit like a girl many stages.
One of the reasons I quite like this on revisiting it is he was accused of being terribly out of touch in the 80s, and that he spiraled off into this, you know, he turned into the guy from Labyrinth, had lost his mind entirely. And this, for all of the supposed out of touchness, he's really trying to get back in touch with the world. There are political lyrics. They're rather crass and gauche. And the version of Working Class Hero
is terrible.
A war crime.
Yeah, it's
but
terrible.
At least he's attempting.
Crack City's pretty bad
pretty
as well.
Shockingly bad,
some of it's really kind of pedestrian political activism, isn't it? Where you think, step away. Mm. But he was trying to do a Pixies, Sonic Youth type thing, I think. I think
Should he have gone darker, though, I think, when I listened to this? Should he have actually gone really Nine Inch Nails and Jane's Addiction?
About its blokiness, I think, is kind of crucial. Because I remember the interviews at the time, and we're Tin Machine and we're geezers.
Yeah. Look at that, coming rocking.
And he sings like that. He has his Geezer Dave voice.
And I don't think, you know, going darker would have actually worked for him at that point. He didn't want to be dark. He wanted to be rock and roller rather than an alien rock star.
He kind of, I can absolutely see why he felt he had to go too far in one direction. It had become so melodic and so poppy. He went off in this direction that was too far for most of us. But as a result, the work that came after kind of came back to the melody, but had some edge still.
I would love, if Bowie had not died, if Bowie had been in fine fettle, wouldn't it be great to have a Tin Machine reunion till now?
Now that would
be pretty fantastic,
just for the sheer fuck you of it.
He removed the second album, which even I couldn't try to defend. It was just absolutely terrible. He removed it from circulation, so you can't actually get that.
Although there's a couple of tracks for it on the Sound and Vision box set when they expanded that. There's a few from the second Tin Machine album there. It's not all turds in a box.
There are now attempts to rehabilitate this. I'm sure I have seen pieces arguing that this foreshadows grunge. I mean, optimistically arguing that it foreshadows grunge.
Generous,
I don't think grunge had anything to do with this, but there are clearly people now wanting to say, let's bring Tin Machine back into the fold.
Who else do we think should resign from solo work and start a rock band? I'm going to say Elton. Who else should do it?
I think it's something Robbie Williams wants to do, and you just think, I wouldn't
mind seeing Paul McCartney do that, actually, just to temper some of his more saturated impulses, because he sort of goes that way live, but to
Go on the road with a load of 25-year-olds.
Or more in the studio with an actual band. I'd like to see what Paul McCartney came up with in the studio with an actual band rather than I am Paul McCartney and I do Paul McCartney.
Okay, we're going to move on. There's nothing quite like a hot new artist that you've never heard of who's on their sixth album. Meg Remy, a.k.a. US Girls, is an Illinois-born Toronto resident who started out making DIY noise pop. But her new album, In a Poem Unlimited, explodes into full-bore, grown-up megapop, which ranges from Shirelle-styled romantic martyrdom through to high-energy wallopers in the Robin vein. Michael Hann is quite the fan. I'm bowled over. We're going to talk about it after this. This is Pearly Gates. Well, like some words that US Girls, a.k.a. Meg Remy, and her collaborators with Pearly Gates. Michael Hann, this is an all-out woman power record, so I'm going to ask the bloke about it first.
Yeah, well,
tell me why you like it.
Obviously, I'm the right person to comment on these things. I first heard of US Girls with the last album, Half Free, which I think was the first to come out on 4AD, and the four before that had all been underground releases that didn't really emerge onto the radar. Half Free, I thought, was great. This, I think, is even better. I mean, it's an album that feels of its time. as you say, it addresses issues of sex and gender, but not it's not in a doer-forbidding way. It's thrilling musically, for all that the lyrics are about sex and gender and power. But it's full of melodies and it's full of detail. It's actually an album that, for all you could imagine dancing to, it works great on headphones because there's so much detail in there. Now, it's been picked up in some of the early reviews as this kind of great feminist statement. In fact, that's been present in her work before. There was tons of that on Half Free. I think it's just that it chimes with the moment, what she's saying.
Yeah. Stop mansplaining. Women, what do you think of it?
You asked me.
I know, because I'm trying to be inclusive and double reverse triple axel. Yeah. Stop mansplaining, yes.
I really liked it. It is very of its time, but at the same time, if you like Minnie Riperton and ABBA, you will
yeah,
love
yeah,
it. The first track, Velvet for Sale, which I think is the single...
Because there's been a few singles.
MAH was the last one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think that the next single then is this. It just sounds so much like Minnie Riperton. There's a bit of Black Gold of the Sun and Loving
Her voice
You.
Is a lovely thing, isn't
it's
it?
A beautiful,
it's a fantastic vibrato.
It's a beautiful voice. But there's loads of kind of ABBA hooks throughout the album, I think. It's really easy to listen to. I totally agree about the headphones thing because some of the lyrics are really like, whoa, you really want to hear exactly what she's saying. It's not just a melody thing where you want to hear the music. I really wanted to hear the lyrics. They're very, very good. Lots of stuff. There's stuff about domestic violence and there's stuff about the Obamas in there, isn't there? And
yeah, I was really annoyed by that actually, because Mad as Hell is a kind of a it's complaint pop about how Obama let her
and the
world
down. I know,
isn't
that interesting?
And I'm like, for God, you read the news. You didn't know when you had it good. I mean, look at the papers.
Yeah,
and
can I just jump to the defence of sometimes you write a song that's not your own point of view. Sometimes you take on a character, and she is a person who seems from this album to be taking on lots of different characters.
Yes.
There's lots of different voices in it. I think you can get lost in it. And I thought, oh, this isn't my sort of thing. I really like it, but I also don't really know why I like it. And I don't really want to know why there's just something about it that's really, really
it's,
rich.
It's one of those things where you look at all it's the rich, stuff that surrounds it, it looks really off-putting and forbidding, and you actually have to listen to the record to realise how good it is. It's like if you look at the lyric sheet and it's clearly, she's not writing song lyrics, so she's writing prose. You look at the
Well, that's why I think it's the poem rhymes. In A Poem Unlimited is this is some stuff from
also,
my brain.
You know, insofar as it matters, the cover is a horrible cover. It looks like a very small time marginal.
I
think the cover's awful. It looks like a very small time marginal record, and that's not what is in on the record at all.
I think her earlier records sounded extremely indie, marginal, we'll do this, we'll clatter the spoon, something. She's just gone, have some pop,
I
and
agree.
That's really good.
I absolutely agree on the music front, but it's presented in the sleeve. And why does that matter anymore? Record sleeves are the size of a postage
stamp.
Yes,
phone,
exactly.
Phone.
Yeah.
But that was just one little thing that make, for God's sake, because for me, and I hate to say the V word, but it, like in the world of St. Vincent, I mean, this is a kind of a part of the same thing where you've got female artists doing things that have never been possible in pop before and really going for doing what the Americans call going for the brass ring, like reaching for the big moment, trying to be not just big in the little world of music, but big in the culture at large.
Yeah, it's rousing, isn't it? Sian's right about the richness of it. I find with this sort of genre of music, as much as I kind of admire and respect it from afar, it often leaves me a bit cold. It feels a bit too technical and anodyne for me.
Yeah.
So things like St. Vincent and Lord even, I sometimes can feel a bit cold after it. But this, I just found it really rousing. I wanted to dance sometimes. I wanted to sing along. I wanted to listen to it in the car, on the train. It's really easy to listen to, despite being something that makes you feel and think and react.
It's actually quite complicated.
It's really complicated,
when you go into the lyrics.
For me, it's like the perfect combination of literate and, you know, full-on widescreen mega pop.
Yeah.
Large chunks of it are like, if you can imagine, I'm Not Scared by Eighth Wonder with a fantastically, you know, connected lyric about
She has
now.
That same range. She has the same range as Kylie. And so it sounds a lot like Kylie from afar. It's what Kylie should have done after Deconstruction,
is
I think.
It proto-Kylie?
I was going to say it's very indie Kylie
Isn't it?
Moments.
Yeah.
It's Me Too Kylie.
Confide in Me, sort of.
Yeah. Me Too Kylie.
It's modern,
what a genre.
Connected Kylie.
With a much better voice.
I think one of the problems with it in terms of how it might be received is that it's being sold so hard as this big serious record. I mean, looking through the press blurb, there's a line: "In A Poem Unlimited In A Poem Unlimited poses a substantial question: can you dance while you think?" Just stop saying it like that. Just give us the bloody album and let us make our own minds up, because it's a great album.
Yeah, that's a slightly Tin Machine lyric.
My question is, can you think while you dance? Because dancing is supposed to stop you thinking.
Yeah.
You're supposed to turn your brain up. But these are fantastic pop records that happen to come within a pop dance framework. And sometimes I kind of slightly kind of bluesy pop framework.
Well, yeah, Rage of Plastics, whenever I play that, I keep singing in my head Black Velvet by Alana Miles.
Oh, you're right. Mm. Yes, it's got that. And also Time sounds like Scott Walker. There are Scott Walker dynamics and harmonics going
it's
on
funny
through
you said
that,
it,
which
I've got,
I thought was really interesting.
Scribble down here, I've got Time sounds like 1981 No Wave single or LCD sound system with bongos.
No, so it's Scott Walker.
both of those things.
Everybody sees it differently.
Absolutely, yeah. Mate. Yeah. I think this is definitely the best record I've heard so far this year by an artist that I had not previously encountered.
Yeah, I'd never heard a thing before.
Absolutely.
It took me by surprise. Yeah.
I love it.
But what I think was, I'm going to keep stressing this again, you should listen to it for pleasure and then let the lyrics and all the rest of it feed into you. Because if you go into it going, I'm going to listen to a dour statement, don't.
It's not
a
dour statement.
Go for the music and then take the message.
It's not remotely a dour statement. No. Okay, let's have another choice of our guests' albums that only they like. Michael Hann, what have you brought in to terrify the listeners with, and why have you brought it in?
I've brought in Bubblegum Music is the Naked Truth, which was the compilation put together by Buddha Records of their bubblegum hits of the late 1960s. The sleeve notes written by Neil Bogart, who went on to become the founder of Casablanca Records, the most prodigious cocaine user in the history of music. And they are great sleeve notes. Bubblegum music. Bubblegum is the naked truth in music. Music was meant to be happy, free, unashamed, relaxed, natural and easy. Easy, easy. But then one day the serpent came slithering down the tree with an apple, and we all started wearing fig leaves. But wait, here's something new. Here's something old. I won't carry on. Okay. You know what 60s sleeve notes are like. They're routinely fantastic and overblown. But what I love about bubblegum music is what Neil Bogart says. It's the presumption of innocence, because it's not actually innocent. If you listen to Yummy, Yummy, Yummy over the age of about 9, it's hard to view it as anything other than pure filth, really. But
your mind, perhaps, Michael, but let's carry on.
Anyway, but this has some kind of residual connection to childhood. The first record I remember hearing, I didn't live in a pop household at all. My dad liked jazz and classical. There were two pop records in the house. One was Eric Burdon's Winds of Change album, and the other was a 7-inch of I Feel Fine and She's a Woman by the Beatles. No idea why they had those two. But what we did also have was two singles in that series, Children's Favourites, do you remember, which were in the early 70s, re-recordings of contemporary hits. One was Simon Says, and one was Yummy, Yummy, Yummy. And I've always loved Yummy, Yummy, Yummy. I think it is pretty much as perfect a pop song as could possibly be written.
Well, I'm going to pause you there because we're going to have one track from this, or a bit of a track. From Bubblegum Music is The Naked Truth. We're going to find out what Sally and Sian think about this afterwards. This track is Jelly Jungle, open brackets of Orange Marmalade, close brackets by The Lemon Pipers. So if you need your colour additives, here they go.
We will fly to a yellow ball of butter where the clouds are as fluffy as a parachute sail.
Jelly Jungle of Orange Marmalade by The Lemon Pipers. Michael Hann was just eulogising bubblegum pop there. Sally, have you ever listened to this stuff before?
Unfortunately, I have to listen to it quite a lot. So I'm married to a 60s obsessive and we play Pop Master against one another every single day. Mm. If we're both home, we're both writers, so we're both at home most of the time. And if we get to 60s bubblegum, we know that he's got it and I haven't. Mm. I'm useless with 60s. I can only do the Beatles and the Stones, and then I can do 70s, 80s, 90s onwards. I cannot do this sort of thing. It drives me up the wall. I don't like jovial. I don't enjoy jovial in a record. I find it irritating. I brought up 2 children. I've had enough of this sort of music from CBeebies. I respect it. I get that he really loves it, but it is a sort of bone of contention between us. I can't listen to it.
Mm. But apart from that, Mrs. Lincoln.
So, like, basically, there's only 3 acts on this album, isn't there, Michael? It's Ohio Express, 1910 Fruit Gum Company, and Shadows of Night. Are they all the same people in different permutations?
Well, no, but the key people in the bubblegum thing were Kazanats and Katz, who were very much the, well, you might say the Chin and Chapman. I would say the Max Martin of their day.
Okay.
They were all about constructing pop songs, then finding the right people to sing them. It didn't really matter who sang them because it was all about what they did. And it's done to a formula, you know. The follow-up to Yummy, Yummy, Yummy was Chewy, Chewy, which in the levels of pop cynicism, I think, really takes the biscuit.
That song is intolerable. It is absolutely...
Well, it's course goes Chewy, 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 Chewy. Yeah, what's not to love about that, Andrew?
It's the kind of thing that you would play at General Noriega when he was trapped in his bunker to drive him insane and get him to come out.
Now, I agree that bubblegum music is not something you want to listen to all day, every day, but I do have a real sweet tooth for the combination of slightly fuzz guitars and really bright pop melodies.
What moments would you listen to it? Give me, because I think this is dreadful. This is my idea of hell. This Same. Is torture. I couldn't even listen to one track. It was just awful. What is the point when you're luxuriating in the bath and you're sitting on the sofa?
I like this for the car.
Oh, yeah. My God. And you still drive? How many points on your license?
Because the not terribly good songs just sort of slip out of your consciousness and then you focus back when something good comes on. I think it's great.
They make me feel like I've got tinnitus. Like, I feel like...
It makes me feel sick.
When if you're eating like a pie or some kind of handheld food and you accidentally swallow a bit of the tinfoil and it goes on a filling. That's the sensation it gives to me, like a shock through the head. But I want to ask you, Michael.
At least I've chosen something that everyone else does.
Hey, yes. You've fulfilled it.
You've done it.
Can I ask you, do you think that one of the reasons you like this may be that as a professional music journalist of knocking on 30 years standing, your working life is filled with the serious, artistically approved stuff, the allegedly good stuff, the canon. And it's all, you know, coming across your desk and going through years. You've got to listen to it for serious matters. This is the antithesis of it. So this is kind of your escape. This is like as John Peel used to listen to the sound of people like throwing a radiator down a lift shaft and saying it was amazing, simply so that he could feel something different. Do you think that might be a bit of the appeal to you?
No.
Okay.
Because I liked it before I ever started writing about music. Yeah? I've always liked bubblegum music. Again, return to when we were students in Leeds together, Andrew. You remember the psychedelic clubs that used to happen, the psychedelic and indie clubs.
Yeah,
like Kaleidoscope.
Terrible
pop.
DJ called Dan Mayer used to play.
There was one called The Wig Out, which used to play quite a lot of bubblegum. And these were songs that were familiar to me from my childhood. I used to love hearing them played over a big sound system. And I would dance. I aged 18, 19. I would dance to Yummy, Yummy, Yummy in a club.
Mm. And meanwhile, the rest of us are wasting our time raving. Raving to Can You Feel It? This is, of course, where you get a lot of that sort of Paisley Underground, and you get ultimately Fountains of Wayne, you know, come from all of this, and the High Lamas and Saint Etienne. And it actually, in its own weird way, is considered slightly canon, is it?
Well, it has a place in pop history. And you know, my favourite band ever, Ramones, were big bubblegum fans. They covered Indian Giver, which features on this. They featured A Little Bit of Soul by the Music Explosion, which isn't on this, but is one of the big Kazanats and Cats classics. I say classics in air quotes, obviously. So it kind of it fed into the much poppier end of punk. I think there is a lot. I mean, punk isn't all about Iggy and the Velvet Underground. It does come back to this as well. The kind of look how cheap and tawdry and tacky we can be, but we've got a melody here too.
Well, there we go. Bubblegum music is the naked truth. The amazing adventures of Kazanats and Cats. Moving on quickly. Superhero movies are seldomly connected to a social agenda. The days when the X-Men stood for marginalised gay and lesbians seem to be a long time ago. But you could be forgiven for thinking that Marvel's new Black Panther is more about the social moment than the character or the story. Outlets that never otherwise care too much about superheroes, like BBC News or the Guardian comment pages, are hectically discussing how this story of the hidden technological kingdom of Wakanda connects with Black Lives Matter and new cultural consciousness amongst African Americans. Does Black Panther add up to Malcolm X in superhero tights? We're going to talk about it after this taster.
My king.
Stop it.
The Black Panther lives.
A war is coming.
That damn calm.
Watch me do my...
I hope you're ready, bro. Because I'm just getting started. Let's have some fun.
A bit from the latest addition to the Marvel Universe there, Black Panther. Now, I confidently predict that I am the only person in this room who's been following this particular character since 1975. Sally Hughes, you went to see Black Panther with one of your kids, as is your duty as a mum.
Yeah.
What did you make of it?
Right, well, I have to see every Marvel film. And last night I took my son, and the deal was that he could fill me in on what happened when I woke up. Because I go to sleep at every single Marvel film we ever go and see, because I think they're broadly terrible. The last one I saw was Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which is one of the worst things I've ever seen. It was awful.
Oh, I love you? Guardians what? Of the Galaxy
I thought it was absolutely terrible.
And you're right, Sally.
So... I went last night. Not only did I stay awake for the entire film, much to the surprise of my children, but I rather enjoyed it.
Oh, my God.
I thought it was good. I have many, many, many problems with it, but none of them are really the film's fault. It's more the genre. I hate that you are supposed... There's this assumed knowledge that you're meant to have. So you're meant to know that he's come back from somewhere. I'm meant to know what he was doing, what the protagonist, the king, was doing in the previous film, which I absolutely don't because I slept through it. You're meant to know... You're meant to understand the whole picture, aren't you,
Sorry,
before you go
Coronation
in.
You're a Coronation Street fan, aren't
no,
you?
No, I don't watch any soaps. I hate soaps. And so I never really know what's going on because I haven't paid attention to all the others. However, I thought it was by far the best of that genre I've seen in a really, really long time. I thought all the performances were good. I thought the jokes were good.
Right, one down, two to go. Michael Hand, what do you think?
Well, by curious chance, I saw the previous one, Captain America Civil War, with my son. And so the backstory bit of this, I was actually awake for. I was asleep for most of
okay.
Captain America Civil War. So I thought, ha-ha, I'm going to be on top of this. But I really hate superhero films. I think they're completely pointless. I think they're all exactly the same. It's way too long. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes, as these films always are. And, you know, kind of, I think the mark of whether an action film for me is working is whether I'm compelled by the action or whether I start wondering about the logistics. And I started wondering about the logistics in
this
one.
You mean you don't believe in a secret African kingdom built on vibranium that no, well, the world doesn't know about?
This is the point, Andrew. If I'm enjoying the film, I'm completely happy to follow the secret African kingdom built on vibranium. But when I'm starting to think, hang on, how is this society so prosperous if it's completely closed and they do not trade with anyone?
Vibranium.
Yeah, you've got to sell the vibranium to someone.
You built stuff out of vibranium.
Yeah, who pays for the building?
You make vibranium coins.
Where in the city was any of the industrial infrastructure needed?
You see it. You see the bloody vibranium mines, mining the vibranium. There's a train, vibranium train.
Yeah, you see a vibranium train. You don't see the factories. I started thinking, why is it a monarchy? Why is this most... That actually, I think, is quite problematic in a film that is about kind of black self-empowerment. Yeah... But they can't be trusted to have a democracy, can they? They still need a monarchy.
Okay.
But the other thing...
Oh, you've gone in very deep.
The thing that really, really, really annoyed me was the nature of Black Panther himself. Because this is a closed society. And yet, for thousands of years, we have had this Black Panther ruling everything because of his secret flower herb thing. But if it's a closed society and Wakanda itself is completely peaceful because of vibranium, what is the point of Black Panther? Black Panther and his predecessors spent thousands of years presumably just not doing
because
anything.
Because they have terrorists. The terrorists went and killed the dad, didn't they?
Well, they've only had terrorists in the last few years.
He's got to save everybody from terrorism.
They've only had terrorists in the last couple of years, but they've had Black Panther for thousands of years not doing anything. Pointless superhero.
I don't think you have to fill in the entire back history of Wakanda in order to make the film make sense. But, you know, it is about, to me, you say it's about, you know, problematic about monarchy and they can't be trusted with democracy. To me, the film is about what is a good king because
it's
the villain
a benign rulership,
is a
isn't it?
Bad king.
Is
they are saddled with a bad king. Now, you can make all the arguments you want against monarchy, but when you look at the monarchy as it's depicted with T'Challa as the king... The whole film is like, what is it to be a good king? He's got his council around him.
Andrew, do you think what is a good king is
no,
king
it's all,
specifically?
No. This is about, it's a film about responsibility. It's a film about handling power responsibly. It's about global responsibility and the fact that do you have a kingdom that exists on its own that's happy, that doesn't help anyone else? And the bad king comes from Oakland, California, where he's seen gang crime and he's seen drug crime and he's seen all sorts of things and knows that this vibranium, they could just hand it over, give a bit of power to not just black people but poor people. How do you do that responsibly? The king
about,
says no.
Yeah, it's about Wakanda pulling up the ladder behind them. That's the point.
Yes, and joining in the conversation. That's a big deal. I thought that was perfectly fine.
I get all those issues. I understand all those issues. However, that didn't stop me thinking it was anything more than another boring superhero film with those issues involved in it.
I get that superhero films are not for everybody, and obviously they're totally for me. I mean, what I really liked about it was that... two things. Firstly, that it took the superhero thing and put it in a completely different context. And I remember when Black Panther first appeared in the comics, Black Panther invented by two white Jewish guys from New York, right? Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, the visionaries of their time in the 1960s. And In the original story, the Fantastic Four, the whitest superheroes there have ever been, pipe-smoking Reed Richards and his nuclear family, they go to Africa expecting it to be basically Darkest Africa and are surprised and floored and defeated in a comedy way by Black Panther, who then becomes their best mate. And they discover that there is this completely different version of Africa. And to me, Wakanda is like wish fulfillment. It connects with the Afrofuturism of Sun Ra.
It's very Sun Ra.
Yeah, it's like,
I thought,
what would it have been like if we had been able to properly put together everything that's in our continent?
Yes, you have natural resources and you have these technological advances. But that's the perfect city. It's a utopia that they've
built.
But
even better than that, it doesn't go for the trite response of, and it's all just down to the colonists. There are some good gags where Martin Freeman and Andy Serkis, the Tolkien white guys, obviously, are kind of, you know, put on the back foot with shut up colonist and this kind of thing. But it's not as trite as simply saying it would have all been great if we hadn't been colonised, because it's about responsibility, and T'Challa is the embodiment of that. What are you going to do? It's the Lion King. How are you going to be a good king?
I thought Martin Freeman was rubbish.
He's
not
great,
is he? I thought his performance was so thin. Mm. I thought everybody else was really good in it, but he wasn't funny or charismatic, or I thought that character was really thin. I didn't get any sort of sense of who that character was. He just seemed like furniture to me.
But in a sense, I'm kind of fine with that, because this is a film about black characters, black actors, a full-on Afro-futurist experience.
No,
I disagree.
I disagree with the idea that characters can be totally rubbish if they're not sort of important to the main plot. It has to count. Every character has to count. And he was the sort of the funny... He was the fall guy in it. Funny things kept happening to him. And I think it would have been much more entertaining if his performance and his role had been better written.
I think he has a point in terms of the things that you've made, the points you've made about the rest of the film, which is that he represents two sides. On the other hand, at first he appears to be evil CIA guy who's doing a deal with evil South African. But also, you know, it's not just as simple as that. He is also on the side of our hero. So, like many of the characters there, it cuts across two sets of themes.
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm now trying to defend
you. You are defending it.
Everyone else is marvellous.
Can I come back with one thing to attack, which is that this incredibly enlightened country breeds one of the world's most endangered animals to be a fighting beast.
Oh, come on.
If you are not here for fighting rhinos, then I can't help you.
A war rhino, come on. This is why we go and see films like this, those of us who go and see them. Fighting rhinos.
I like the rhinos.
Also, I like the fact that the society you mentioned, you know, nothing happens in Wakanda. It is a divided society. There's the gorilla tribe, who will not be part of the Black Panther monarchy. They've gone off to live in the hills and do their own thing.
Oh, they were really great.
I agree, they were good.
Yeah,
yes.
So it is a varied society. Wakanda has a geography. It's not just Darkest Africa. There are different parts.
Sometimes there were lots of themes I thought that they didn't get to. And you're right about the CIA character. He just becomes very, very two-dimensional as soon as he's in Wakanda. And the gorilla people, they could have been... Oh, I love them.
The leader of the gorilla tribe
felt like there was another film in them.
I felt straddling the line, are we a real film or are we a comic book film? And there's bits where it's very cartoony and then it goes a bit serious and it's very cartoony. I wasn't sure whether they were sure.
But that's comics. It's like, can you import seriousness and still maintain the comic world?
I felt it had that kind of Kill Bill thing where you're not really sure if you're in the real world or whether it's a sort of parallel.
So basically, what we're saying is that Sally and Sian and I all agree. Michael's wrong, and this is a fantastic film. 3-1, we win. You're wrong. Let's move on. Finally, Sian Pattinson, what's your album that nobody likes?
My album is something that no one likes until they hear it, I hope. It is Surround Yourself with Cilla by the incomparable Cilla Black, Cilla Black's fourth studio album, produced by Mr. George Martin. Didn't make the charts. It's absolutely wonderful. And I love it, love it, love it. And I've put it on loads this week and been walking around to it. And it's made me so happy.
Let's have a taste. This is the title track from Surround Yourself with Cilla. This is Surround Yourself with Sorrow. That was Cilla Black with Surround Yourself with Sorrow from the 1969 album Surround Yourself with Cilla. I think more bands should call their names after their hit songs. Noel Gallagher should have an album called It's a Beautiful Noel. And Ed Sheeran's album should be called Shape of Ed. or we should have Can't Stop the Timberlake. Sean, why is this album so fantastic?
This album is fantastic because I think Cilla, poor woman, has been seen as the Laura laughs, surprise, surprise, blind date. Oh, yeah, I knew the Beatles. Oh, yeah, I've done this, that and the other. And look at my big gob kind of person. And this album is full of vulnerability. It's full of tenderness. She can really, really sing.
Yeah.
This, you know, this, we are obviously not in the days of auto-tune or any kind of fiddling about. Her voice is just beautiful, going from silent and softly spoken to this, you know, a massive sort of Beyoncé-killing voice that she has at points. Most of the songs about lost love. They're about being thwarted. They're about, as I say, this vulnerability with her. Had she gone on this tip, I think she would have done a lot better. It's just so tender and so lovely. And I feel sad that she is the Laura Laugh Cilla when she can produce this stuff. And the music is beautifully chosen for her. It's wonderful. The arrangements are fantastic. I can go on, I won't.
Parts of it are as good as Dusty Springfield.
Yes.
You know, you kind of, and in a way, the quality of the voice, it's a little bit like you hear it again in that US Girls album we were just talking about, a beautiful, delicate vibrato that's just hanging in midair.
It's a soprano, isn't it?
Is it a surprise? I don't know
the
technical terms.
I think it is a soprano.
Sally, what did you reckon?
It's difficult with Cilla. Years ago, when I was working on a magazine, somebody said that they couldn't listen to Michael Stipe because even though they loved R.E.M., Michael Stipe's voice was just, there was a chemical reaction to it. And I have the same thing with Cilla. Her voice drives nails into me. And it's a shame because actually there are some beautiful songs on here. I agree, the arrangements are gorgeous. It feels sort of grand but small and gentle and vulnerable. I really love lots of the songs, but her voice... I'm not saying it's a technically bad voice, but there's something about the tone of it that drives nails into me. Also, Liverpool Lullaby actually makes me cringe.
That may not be the best song. Yeah.
It's terrible. It's
mortifying.
Yeah.
I don't know where my bum goes up its own bum.
On behalf of everybody from Liverpool, you know, born in my town, I have to say we apologise and we don't want to think about it. Oh, you are a mucky kid. Stop.
It feels like the kind of thing that was written to be sung on a variety show, not on an album.
Yeah. And it's most unlike Liverpudlians to self-mythologise as well.
Yeah, I really liked it.
Did you think it was going to be like before you heard it?
I thought it was going to be a lot more like Liverpool Lullaby. I thought it was going to be really kind of tooth-grinding and, you know, it was going to be a variety show seller. And actually... It seems to be the last time Cilla wasn't variety show. It was her last gasp. Mm. And actually, as you say, this was the flop album. So this is the cool one. This is the one to mention. I'm really into the fourth one that nobody liked.
What year is this one from?
69, wasn't it?
Okay. So this is a bit late for her very brief psychedelic phase.
But the cover is psychedelic. It's wonderful. She's an amazing miniature.
I can't remember what her amazing psych track is. There is something amazing. I mean, I can't, unsurprisingly, given I like bubblegum, kind of ersatz psych is a favourite genre of mine, as I suspect it may be with your husband. And Cilla did have some great forays into that in the late 60s.
There are some lovely songs on it, for sure. And and the unrequited love thing, as you say, it just keeps coming back. And you do see her as a sort of vulnerable, perpetually heartbroken person who doesn't really know what to do with her feelings.
Which actually, that was the kind of... that was the defining position of late 60s girl pop, wasn't it? It was like, it was tragedian. And there's a great line on, I don't know who wrote the song Think of Me. There's a line, it's pure Morrissey. If you love me, it would be the beginning of me. It's like, this is like powerful.
Yeah. And there's a sense, but with people like Dusty Springfield, although those are absolutely the themes, you always feel with Dusty, you're going to be all right because you're nails, you're Dusty Springfield, you're going to be all right. But with Cilla, it really feels like she's a bit of a broken bird. You know, you don't know if she's going to be all right. It feels really heartbreaking when you listen to it.
Is it as heartbreaking as the title sequence of Blind Date, though? That broke my heart in very, very different other ways. Listeners, find it on Spotify. Untick Liverpool Lullaby.
Yeah.
And just play the extra tracks,
absolutely.
Which are great.
Yes. Surround Yourself with Sorrow in Spanish.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a corker. I enjoy that.
Later done by Annie from ABBA. It is one of her solo singles we discover from Wikipedia.
Who is your voice that drives nails into you? Everyone has one, right?
My voice that drives nails into me that I cannot bear to listen to. The thing that drives... It's not one person, but it unfortunately, it is the default voice of now, which is the slightly...
broken whimper of modern
the girl
pop.
Whose sleeves are too long.
I'm just not really very happy.
But I might have a ukulele playing in the back, and that makes me would make me smash the radio.
That's one of mine. Yeah.
I would go with Michael Stipe actually as one of them. Oh, yeah, nasal. Hello, nasal.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Get some lockets.
I love his voice. I've never cared for Tony Hadley's voice.
Foghorn Hadley.
Foghorn.
You can live a life avoiding Tony Hadley's voice quite successfully, I think.
Not if you watch BBC Four.
I love a bit of club style. Tony Hadley's very much a pop singer, and I like that.
Yeah. Anyway, we're coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be talking about as they down a foaming Wakandan cocktail? Sally Hughes.
So first of all, I was going to tell everyone to watch The Comeback of This Country, which starts next week. It's my favourite comedy of last year. It's absolutely amazing, and it's on the BBC. But I am also going to use this opportunity to say I launched a charity today that I would really like people to help with. It's called Beauty Banks, and it's about hygiene poverty. There are 13 million people in this country living in poverty, and over half of them can't afford essential toiletries like razors, tampons, sanitary towels, shaving gel, and so on. If you go onto The Pool, which is the-pool.com, my column from today has everything you need to know, but all we want is your toiletries, and we will distribute them to people living in poverty via food banks across the country. We don't want your money. We don't want anything other than that. Just give us some toiletries.
That was very Bob Geldof owning it there. Give us the feckin' soap. an
give amazing, us some tampons.
An amazing worthy cause. What's it called again? It's called Beauty Banks.
It's called Beauty Banks. And we've launched today, and all you have to do is send your toiletries to the address, which is on my column in The Pool, Market Beauty Banks, and we will do literally everything else. So we will collate, sort, package thoughtfully according to area and needs, and we will distribute them via the Trussell Trust, which is the country's biggest food bank network.
Really fantastic. Where there's soap, there's hope. Sean Pattenden, what have you got?
Well, I've been doing all sorts of things. I was going to talk about CDs again, but I won't. I've been painting, as you know, I do art as well. I've been painting takeaway cartons this week.
Okay.
And I don't think to much success yet, but I'm going to get there, and that's going to be on the website, and that's going to be really good.
Is there a campaign aspect to the painting of takeaway cartons?
There's always a campaign. There's always a political agenda. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so but I can't tell you yet.
This will be on the rawart.co.uk.
Yeah, it will do at some point, or I'm going to actually try and force somebody to put it on a wall somewhere.
Fair dues.
But that's quite hard.
Michael Hamm, what have you got?
I feel inadequate because I don't do art or set up charities, but I was writing something about Spaceman 3, and I reread Will Carruthers' memoir from a couple of years ago, Playing the Bass with Three Left Hands, which I commend to anyone and everyone as possibly the funniest music memoir ever written that involves copious use of heroin. There's the fantastic section where Spaceman 3 go to play in the reception at Brentford Waterman Arts Centre, just playing one chord for 45 minutes, which later gets released as the album Dream Weapon, An Evening of Contemporary Sitar Music, where Will Carruthers realises at the end of 45 minutes that he hadn't actually turned his amp on, as he says, a monkey could have done what I just did. An imaginary monkey could have done what I just did. And then the section where Spaceman 3 have their first major interview and Will's all excited about it and his mum's all excited about it because Chris Roberts has gone up to Rugby to interview Sonic Boom. And then Will Carruthers comes home one lunchtime and his mum is standing there in the garden with Melody May going, what's this? It's all about drugs. What will your auntie think? I told her to buy a copy. But it's a great book. It's well worth reading.
What's it called again?
Playing the Bass with Three Left Hands by Will Carruthers.
Okay. Is this new or is this positive?
It came out a couple of years ago.
Okay, fair dues. Well, my closing time chatter is probably tying up many of the themes of this show, David Bowie and comic books. The great comic book writer Pat Mills, co-creator of 2000 AD, creator of Judge Dredd, all these things. He's on Twitter all the time. And I spotted a conversation between him and Duncan Jones, son of David Bowie, on Twitter the other day. And Duncan Jones is saying to the creator of 2000 AD, I would love to do your strip Slain, which is about a barbarian, kind of Celtic barbarian in sort of pre-Roman times, ancient Britain. It's a massive, sprawling epic. It's it's got magic, it's got monsters, it's got a subtext about conquest and imperialism. We were talking about Britannia on Sky on the show the other day, and the consensus was they should have made Slain instead. So Duncan Jones, son of David Bowie, said, oh, I'd snap your hands off if I could have Slain to make this, but apparently the rights are unattainable. And Pat Mills replies, oh, no, I've just talked to Rebellion, the publishers. The rights are available, so go on,
wonderful,
knock yourself out. So I watched a movie deal.
How
on TV,
brilliant.
Done live on Twitter between, you know, two heroes.
That's
and
amazing.
Like, I do know that, like, David Bowie and Duncan Jones used to read 2000 AD when Duncan was a kid, which gives me a warm feeling of connection. Yes. But the idea that this amazing thing could have been sorted out on Twitter
what
before
I
your very eyes.
What I love about this show is we get Duncan Jones and David Bowie on almost every
pretty much,
week.
Yeah. Well, my favourite thing about this is, of course, immediately
you got comics in.
Up pops the headline, well, you can make Aladdin slain. What could be better?
Strong.
There you go. So, so that's the end of the show. Thank you to Sally Hughes and Michael Hand. Please do come in again. Thank you to Sian for co-anchoring. Thank you to our producer, Jack Claremont, who's twiddling the knobs like a good one in the background. Remember, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth. If you want to support the show, please buy us a pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. You can find that link at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page as well. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks to our guests. And we'll see you again next week. Bye.